goodness, look at that calendar. October is just about behind us. Unbelievable. What do we have here? The 26th of October already. And that means that, that means All Hallows Eve is coming up. Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you so much for your company. You know what, George? We've been doing this show almost now for 10 years. Coming up on that pretty soon.
Yep.
October 31st marks the first day. Oh, we started it back in 2004, so, you know, like 9 years. So we're coming up on that decade mark, and boy. Hundreds of shows we've done, and thanks to our wonderful guests, we've really had some great time. And thank you for the nice feedback you give us, the critical feedback, all of it. We appreciate it very much. So we have a show for you today. By golly, it's 12:07. You just heard the temperature, 43 degrees. Not too bad of a deal for a late October day. George, a good week for you?
So far, yes, it has been.
So far, well, I'll see if I can do something about that, pal. Okay. No, I want to make it even better for you. If I can.
Okay.
All right. Well, I mentioned Halloween coming up this coming Thursday. Yep, 31st.
Mm-hmm.
All Hallows Eve, and that means music. And on our weekly show, we call it the All Request and Dedication Show, which I'm happy to host Monday through Friday here on KLBB, noon to 2. We're going to be dipping into the Halloween music file. We're going to be digging deep in some cases. We're going to be having a lot of fun with this stuff. We're going to sprinkle it throughout the week, but really heavy up on Thursday. We're going to be playing such things as Haunted House by Jumpin' Gene Simmons, Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr., mm-hmm. Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon, of course, Spooky by the Classics 4. That's a great song. Let's see, Waltz in Black, maybe. That's by the Stranglers. Ooh, that's kind of dark, isn't it? Maybe we'll pass on that. A song called Hell by the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Pass on that, George. Clap for the Wolfman by the Guess Who. And Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo. Boy, oh boy, there's a canon of musical greatness for you, huh? Well, the one, though, we think of most is kind of the unofficial anthem of Halloween. Mm-hmm. Something done by, I think conceived by and sung by a guy named Robert George Pickett. He won fame under the name of Bobby Boris Pickett, and of course he was known for co-writing and performing the 1962 hit novelty song Monster Mash. Just a bit of background before we hear it. Pickett was born in just outside of Boston. His father was a theater manager, and as a nine-year-old, Bobby Boris watched many horror films, and he would later incorporate impressions of them in his Hollywood, California nightclub act in 1959. Pickett, as we say, co-wrote Monster Mash with a guy named Leonard Capizzi in May of 62. The song was a spoof on the dance crazes popular at the time, including the twist and something called the mashed potato, which inspired the title, Monster Mash. Yep. The song featured Pickett's impersonations of veteran horror stars Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. Of course, the latter with the line, "Whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?" And it was passed over by, the song was passed over by every major record label. They didn't want it. But after hearing the song, a guy named Gary Paxton agreed to produce and engineer it. And among the musicians who played on it was pianist Leon Russell. Yep. So, issued on Paxton's Garpax record label, the single became a million sellers. So, ladies and gentlemen, the unofficial anthem of Halloween, a little bit early, but here we go. Let's go direct to the laboratory. And Bobby, a Boris, a Pickett. The chemicals are bubbling now, Bobby.
When my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east, to the master bedroom and the vampire's feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guest included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son.
Wow.
scene was rocky, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, back by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It got on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Jack's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on and flashed.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Everything's cool, Jack's a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what is said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And you, my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
From 1962, big million seller, the let's call it the anthem of Halloween, the Monster Mash by Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers. I always thought he said, tell him Gordy sent you. I think it's tell him Boris sent you. That must be it. Love the lyrics. They're very clever. The ghouls all came from their humble abodes to get a jolt from my electrodes. Oh, boy, that's fun. Well, 12:13, thought we'd have a little fun, little nonsense here, and before we plunge into full immersion in our topic today, and that is a pun, but I think it fits. 2 days ago, in both Twin Cities daily newspapers, there was a story that grabbed a lot of people's attention. And no, it was not a banner headline or a major story, but one that recalls the days of yesteryear when distilled spirits flowed through the public's consciousness and their bodies. Here's the opening paragraph as printed Thursday in the Star Tribune. A new distillery, the first in the Twin Cities since Prohibition, is poised to become the latest specialty business that is shaking and, yes, stirring things up in the former Hams Brewery complex on St. Paul's East Side. The word prohibition, well, root word prohibit. In this context, it was the federal government outlawing the manufacture, sale, and transporting of alcohol. Prohibition held on from 1920 to 1933. There was nothing in that law that said you couldn't drink the stuff. And if you got your hands on it, and lots of people did, well, there it was. It went right down the hatch. Yep. Banning booze was called the noble experiment. As it turned out, it was a rather ignoble experiment. It did not work. 2 weeks from today, the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul unveils a new exhibit. It's called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Dan Spock, the History Center's Director of Museums, is with us in studio today to preview the exhibit and to talk about Prohibition in Minnesota and why things went so terribly wrong. Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Stan.
Thank you, thank you. You all geared up and ready to go with it. This is, something of a traveling exhibit?
Yeah, it comes to us from the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
Okay. Yes, and yeah. It's a big one. You're all choked up. Can I give you a drink, Dan?
I've got a little burr in my throat, but I'm fine.
All right.
No, the National Constitution Center's mission is to help people understand our founding document, the United States Constitution. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what's really interesting about the amendment to the Constitution that banned the sale, transport, and manufacture of alcohol is it's the only amendment to the Constitution that was ever repealed. So, you know, you've got one amendment, the 18th, mm-hmm. that makes alcohol illegal, and then you've got the 21st, mm-hmm. Which repeals prohibition. So it's a fascinating story. You could ask, what in heaven's name were people thinking when they thought it was a good idea to ban alcohol in the United States. But the exhibit does an excellent job of sort of describing what the social forces were that were behind this movement to ban alcohol. and how, you know, the country could have talked itself into such a ignoble experiment, as you described it.
It was. What was it that prompted this, then? We're just, the country is just out of World War One. That ends in 1918, November.
Yeah.
And, by the way, we should mention that between the 18th Amendment that established Prohibition and the repealer, the 21st, there was the 19th Amendment, which gave the vote to women.
And that's
that was,
right.
That was tied to this whole movement.
Well, absolutely. Yes. Women were one of the main drivers behind Prohibition, and you know, social progressives of that time period saw alcohol as the main cause of men drinking up the paycheck,
right,
coming home and abusing wives and children, mm-hmm. And they were absolutely ardent in their opposition to alcohol, and they thought that by banning it by law, they could clear up these social problems that seemed to dog American society at that time. So women were very much involved in it. But they joined in a kind of a coalition of what, you know, we could call strange bedfellows politically. Because not only were social progressives involved in this, Christian fundamentalists, particularly in the Bible Belt in the South.
Ku Klux Klan.
The Ku Klux Klan and anti-immigrant people. Right, Ku Klux Klan were anti-Catholic. And the stereotype of the time that it was all Irish, Italian, and Germans who are drinking all the booze,
and we know how we felt about Germans after World War One.
So there was this cresting anti-German sentiment. But one of the other drivers, or at least one of the things that made Prohibition possible, is the 16th Amendment. Now, do you remember what the 16th Amendment
is? I haven't read it in front of me, Dan, but it's in a book. I can't get to it in time to make it sound like I know,
Stan,
right off the top.
Stan, it's okay, because I didn't know
either. What was the 16th?
The 16th Amendment is the national income tax.
That's right. You know what? And I'm going to show you something. I have it right here. Right?
That's right.
The 16th Amendment,
in 1913, the 16th Amendment is ratified, and so that makes a national income tax in the nation possible.
Right.
But what that does is it relieves the federal treasury of having to rely on 40% of its income coming from tax on liquor.
Ah.
So without the necessity of having that stream of income, it also becomes politically tenable to ban alcohol in the United States.
Oh, boy. There's a risk of oversimplifying, but the drive movement, the Prohibition drive, was led by rural Protestants in both political parties in large part, and was coordinated by a group entity called Anti-Saloon League. And anti-prohibitionists, the Wets as they were called, criticized the alcohol ban as something of an intrusion of mainly rural Protestant ideals on a central aspect of urban immigrant and Catholic everyday life. And again, not all Catholics, but a lot of them were against prohibition because it was an intrusion.
And people have pointed out that really the Constitution historically has only, it's generally been about guaranteeing rights and expanding rights, or at least clarifying what rights we have in this nation. Prohibition is unique, or almost unique, in the sense that it actually tried to limit rights, and the only other comparable example of that in the Constitution is limiting the right to own slaves.
That's right. And to echo that, in his fine book, Daniel Okrent wrote Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, almost a title similar to your exhibit. This was this book came out almost in conjunction with Ken Burns' documentary.
That's right.
PBS.
Yeah, and I should just point out that Daniel Okrent was also the curator of this exhibit.
That we're going to see.
Yeah, that's right.
Marvelous. So. Okrent writes in part, and this echoes your point, he asks the rhetorical question, how did prohibition, happen? How did a freedom-loving people decide to give up a private right that had been freely exercised by millions upon millions since the first European colonists arrived in the New World? How did they condemn to extinction what was, at the very moment of its death, the fifth largest industry in the nation? Liquor. How did they append to their most sacred document, the Constitution, 112 words that knew only one precedent in American history? With that single previous exception, the original Constitution and its first 17 amendments limited the activities, as you said, Dan, of government, not of citizens. Now, with Prohibition, there were two exceptions. You could not own slaves, and you couldn't buy alcohol.
That's right.
That's it.
So, yeah.
This was really new, and many people thought warped, and it couldn't work, and they were right.
Well, when you ask the question, how could it have happened? One of the things that the exhibit does an excellent job of illuminating is the career of this now completely forgotten guy, Wayne Wheeler, from the Anti-Saloon League. And during the period and the run-up to Prohibition, he was arguably the most powerful person in American politics, even though he was unelected. He was a lobbyist, and he really sort of invented the whole idea of pressure politics. And if you think about, you know, how elections are won, he cultivated a whole national coterie or constituency of single-issue voters, people who would make up their mind who to vote for entirely on the prohibition issue. And so with a fairly small minority in every voting district, he was able to throw his weight entirely toward one candidate or another. Mm. So it was completely bipartisan, the prohibition movement. You know, it didn't line up along standard traditional American ideological lines. And he was tremendously effective. He could punish a candidate who crossed him up by throwing the votes the other way.
Wow.
And by you know, 1919, he had effectively locked up Congress with enough votes that would, you know, muster the supermajority necessary to get the amendment passed in Congress.
A one-man megalith, a guy, you know, a super committee or a pack all of, unto himself.
Well, he was a little guy, but apparently a real dynamo.
Wow.
And he just ruthlessly pulled the levers necessary in order to get the supermajority that he needed.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, you know, we tend to think of people, you know, like Grover Norquist or these sort of super lobbyists today who hold people's feet to the fire on a single issue like taxes or something like that as being a unique feature of today's political life. But, you know, Wayne Wheeler, who we all have forgotten today, is the prototype guy who really invented the idea of pressure politics and actually coined the term pressure politics.
Really?
My
goodness, Wayne, there's a name to reckon with. And thank you for the story. Another figure probably not forgotten but never known very well goes back to the late 18th century, a Dr. Benjamin Rush. And he was a physician in the time of the late 18th century. And this guy had it right way back then. He wrote this in 1784 about the effects of alcohol. Rush argued, Dr. Rush, that the excessive use of alcohol was injurious to physical and psychological health and went so far as to label drunkenness as a disease.
Uh-huh.
He was right on the money, wasn't he? Way back then. Nobody listened to the doctor.
Well, he was Benjamin Franklin's best friend.
Was
so,
he really?
You know,
okay.
He kept some pretty smart company.
Well, he did.
Now, Benjamin Franklin, it should be pointed out, was no teetotaler.
he flew kites and did that stuff, but he also had a tip or two, didn't he? A little tipple here and now. Yeah. How about this man, Andrew Volstead, Dan Spock?
Well, he's probably our strongest local angle, and the bill that became Prohibition became the amendment. Was often called the Volstead Act. And mainly because he sponsored the bill in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, you know, he was only part author. Wayne Wheeler pretty much drafted the amendment as it eventually got ratified. And he, one of the interesting features of the exhibit is that there's a media presentation that will take you through all the different drafts of the amendment. So you can sort of see how they were fiddling with the language and trying to kind of frame it just right. There's that old expression from Bismarck that, you know, nobody should see sausages and legislation being made.
But this is
an opportunity where you can kind of get a window into it.
And
you know,
it's
still
ugly.
There's a beautiful part of the exhibit as well that shows this. It's sort of like this big glockenspiel that shows all the little mechanisms that had to flip and turn and and go in order to make prohibition a reality.
Oh, folks, when America went dry, starting back in 1920 until 1933, we're talking with Dan Spock here of the Minnesota History Center and the forthcoming exhibit there, The American Spirits, the Rise and Fall of Prohibition. We'll continue our discussion about this with Dan Spock right after this. I'm Stan Turner with exciting news for book lovers. Downtown Stillwater has just completed its new pedestrian walkway next to Valley Bookseller. Park right next to the store, then enjoy your new books out on the deck or on Stillwater's new patio overlooking the St. Croix. Valley Bookseller is indeed the Twin Cities' most beautiful bookstore. Great books, great people, great view. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barber shop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
January is coming fast. Why is this so important? Well, that's when Tom, Sarah, and I take the great plunge. The polar bear plunge, that is. For the third year, we are jumping into the freezing water to help raise money for the Special Olympics and their athletes, just like our favorite little girl, Caroline Smith. We are KLBB Team Caroline.
Special Olympics Minnesota trainings and competitions happen every day. They offer 17 Olympic-style sports year-round. Whatever age or skill level, Special Olympics has something for everyone.
Through sports, athletes are seeing themselves for their abilities, not disabilities. They become confident and empowered by their accomplishments while making new friends in a global community that is growing every day. Visit KLBBRadio.com to make someone's dreams a reality by donating. Also, watch past videos of us all taking the plunge. All proceeds go to the Special Olympics.
Go Team Caroline!
We are back. Lots to talk about. A forthcoming exhibit at the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And with us from the History Center, Dan Spock. And Dan, we are talking about Minnesotan Andrew Volstead, a congressman who helped define exactly how the 18th Amendment prohibition...
From Granite Falls.
From Granite Falls, a granite man whom the voters threw out next election.
Yes.
Say the exhibit has some hate mail about the congressman.
Yeah, you know, in our collection at the Minnesota Historical Society, we have a good-sized folder of hate mail directed at Andrew J. Volstead. And it's interesting to read it because, you know, as you would expect, a lot of it is people who are upset that alcohol has been banned. It took a lot of people apparently completely by surprise that this is actually, it happened so quickly, ultimately when it did happen, that people were shocked when it really did happen. But there are also people who are complaining because they think the law doesn't go far enough. You know, there were exceptions, medical exceptions, things like that, sacramental wine.
Right.
And, of course, preservation of fruit by households through fermentation. And
there's a loophole if I ever saw one.
Well, you know, so people were upset that they felt, the other thing is that it didn't ban drinking. You know, if you were caught in a speakeasy raid, the best thing to do if you weren't the owner of the place was just to sit there because you couldn't be arrested for imbibing. You could only be arrested if you were selling. So plenty of ways to slip around the law.
Oh, yes, yes. And there were some big nightclubs and speakeasies around the Twin Cities, too, back then, right?
Well,
the boulevards of Paris, the
Twin Cities. You know, a lot of big cities at that time period were corrupt, but St. Paul in particular set a kind of a new standard for corruption.
A new low
this
standard.
Time period.
That's absolutely right. And may I, if I could, from a book that the Minnesota Historical Society Press has recently published, and we had the author on this show here about a month ago, Tim Mahoney, called Secret Partners, Big Tom Brown and the Barker Gang.
A terrific read,
It is a terrific read, a story that needs to be told. Chief Big Tom Brown, he was St. Paul police chief in 1930, and Tim Mahoney writes in part, Brown kept an office. And this guy was as crooked as they come. I mean, corrupt beyond belief. Brown kept an office on the third floor of the luxurious Hotel St. Paul, just a few steps from the office of his, quote, little friend, Leon Gleckman, a notorious bootlegger and crime figure who owned both the mayor and the city council at the time. To both offices came a parade of bootleggers, gamblers, con men, saloon keepers, pimps, and hustlers. The cheerful Mr. Dunn was a frequent visitor. By day, he was W.W. Dunn, sales manager of the Hams Brewery. By night, he was Billy Dunn, St. Paul's preeminent bag man, shuttling illicit cash all over town. So here's the story. Both Hams and Schmidt's breweries played along with the bootleggers and the gangsters. In St. Paul, the system worked through Harry Sawyer of the notorious Green Lantern, where all the hoodlums checked in, and yep. Jack Pfeiffer, a fixer and a con man if there ever was one. And finally, one last graph from Brown's from Mahoney's book here. In St. Paul, the Jacob Schmidt Brewery secretly owned a piece of the Green Lantern, the gangster's hangout, and its illegal beer was sold there. The Green Lantern's Harry Sawyer was also in charge of bootlegging Schmidt's beer all over St. Paul. Well, Dan?
Right. So the very idea that a mammoth brewery like the Schmidt's Brewery, which, you know, is a historic structure that still exists and is now being renovated into artist lofts, and as you said earlier, they're going to have a new distillery there.
Yeah.
Imagine that right through Prohibition, from one end to the other, it's still making beer and selling it in St. Paul.
Almost like a pipeline from Schmidt's to the Green Lantern, just about literally. Here's the key point, and this is the law of unintended consequences. Prohibition fostered big-time crime, the mafia, big-time hoods like Al Capone, and the smaller fry like we had here, like Leon Gleckman and Benny Gleeman, a bootlegger over on the Minneapolis side of things. Mm-hmm. And Dan, see if you agree with this. This in the research here, from its very inception, the Prohibition Law lacked legitimacy in the eyes of the public, who had previously been drinkers and yet completely law-abiding citizens. The public, in some cases, viewed the laws as being arbitrary and unnecessary, and therefore they, the public, were willing to breach them, to break them. Consequently, law enforcement agents had not been who had not been bribed to turn a blind eye found themselves overwhelmed by the dramatic rise in the illegal distribution of booze on such a wide scale due to the Volstead Act. The scale of the task was not anticipated, and consequently, the necessary resources to pursue it by law enforcement were not allocated. So,
Well, it's important to point out that the amendment to the Constitution was silent on how law enforcement would happen. You know, there were all these adjustments that had to be made. Yeah. You know, the federal government experimented with a number of different things, but mostly left it up to the Treasury to try to enforce it, since previously liquor taxes had been reaped by the IRS. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. The so-called pro-high agents were notoriously
pro-high.
Yeah, they were. There was a lot of corruption among them, and then of course local enforcement was a lot easier to buy if you were a criminal, because you didn't need as much money really to win over a local official. So. You know, right off the bat, I mean, you have a long history of organized crime in the United States, but before Prohibition, it was pretty much limited to gambling and prostitution rackets. Mm-hmm. And with Prohibition, it's booze. The flow of booze just becomes a river of money that's available to organized crime, and you get a lot of competition about who's going to be distributing and you know, who's going to be making this booze and who's going to be profiting mm-hmm. from it, and that competition over territory turned deadly in many, many instances. Mm-hmm. And you start to see, you know, the skeleton of a national a national syndicate controlling the booze and all the other rackets as well.
Okay. Prohibition spawned the mafia, basically, and made possible people like Capone.
That's right. I think it's important to say that there was some mafia in localized areas beforehand, but you know, the idea of consolidating it because circumventing Prohibition involved carrying things over international borders, mm-hmm. bringing things in from the ocean, mm-hmm. from the Caribbean, from Canada, from Europe, and so forth. You know, you really needed networks that were national in scope.
Yeah.
And so you wind up with, you know, the outfit in Chicago getting its tendrils all over the country.
Right.
And certainly the New York mob under the infamous Murder Incorporated gang also consolidated its power nationally as well.
Of course, Canada and Mexico had booze during our prohibition, and mm-hmm. so there's a lot of border running there. The Edward, Prince of Wales, who would later become King Edward VIII, this is a great story. He returned to Britain following his 1919 tour of Canada, and he recounted to his father, and this is just on the cusp of prohibition, but it was, you know, going to go dry. He recounted to his father, King George V, a ditty he'd heard at a border town, a town along the Canadian-U.S. border. It goes this way. 24 Yankees, feeling very dry, went across the border to get a drink of rye. When the rye was opened, the Yanks began to sing, God Bless America, but God Save the King. And Dan Spock, Dan's with us from the Minnesota History Center, talking about the forthcoming exhibit there, The American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Dan, otherwise God-fearing, law-abiding citizens were making hooch at home.
Yeah.
And I know listeners are out there right now saying, oh yeah, grandma or great-grandma or my uncle making bathtub gin.
Sure.
And lots of people were doing it.
Yeah, I, you know, most people have some sort of a family story related to prohibition.
Yeah.
In my experience, anyway, I know that my grandfather, who was a medical doctor in New York during the 20s,
mm-hmm.
He was able to get grain alcohol as a doctor, and so he told me stories about making bootleg gin for parties in his bathtub. You
yep.
know, and he said you could go to Bloomingdale's and get gin drops. You know,
gin drops.
So you could try to approximate the flavor of gin, and he said the thing to do is to try to decant it into Gordon's bottles, because that was considered the most reputable brand.
My Gordon's, go Gordon's.
Yeah.
If you're going to get blasted on gin.
Yeah.
Bill Ward of the Minneapolis Star Tribune had a wonderful story about 2 years ago on this subject. I'm going to read it. It's a very short story about homemade hooch during Prohibition. Mm. Quote, yeah, we made booze right there in our house, unquote. Linnea Gordon might be 98 years of age, but she retains vivid memories of the Prohibition era in Minneapolis when she and her husband Vernon Buck made and sold moonshine at her parents' home on Nicollet Avenue South in Minneapolis. Like many home distilleries in the early 1930s, they did a thriving business and consorted with other underground characters, including the notorious Isidore Blumenfeld, a.k.a., yes, Kid Can. Mm-hmm. I suppose you could say Vernon was a gangster, she said. He made booze and...
Yeah.
He sold booze and... He made booze and sold booze and carried a gun wherever he went. The two eventually divorced, and Buck went straight, or at least into politics, at one point becoming assistant state counselor. But during the latter years of Prohibition, the two of them, this married couple in Minneapolis, concocted a clear liquor from grains in the basement of the South Minneapolis home and added brown food coloring. My mom put on the labels, Gordon yeah. recalled recently. Yeah. She wanted to make sure they were straight and looked nice. Weekends were particularly frenetic. They did brisk business out of their home on Friday nights and Saturdays, then headed north to the family cabin near Mille Lacs with more hooch in tow. She said, we had customers all day and from all over the place. And what about the cops? What about the long arm of the law? Quote, oh, coppers, cops. They were our very best customers.
Yeah.
That's Linnea Gordon, 98 years old, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think that's a fairly typical case. There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the things that's great about this exhibit is, you know, it really digs into this wonderful period in American history, the Roaring Twenties, which I think still to this day have such a fascination for people. And mm-hmm. you think about, you know, the recent Great Gatsby movie or the Boardwalk Empire series, you know, the sort of allure of the Roaring Twenties has never really dimmed. But, you know, you sort of look at this and you think about, the story, so, some really important things that are happening, partly because of prohibition, and partly because of women getting the vote. So you see women being empowered to a degree that they've never been empowered before. Prior to prohibition, women weren't really allowed in the men's clubs of the saloons. But with prohibition and the speakeasies, all the kind of social conventions got loosened up. And so you have the dawn of the age of the flapper, you know, young women who are empowered. They're able to vote. They're going out at night and partying. And so this sort of mystique of the 20s is really kicking off in great form at that time. And the exhibit has, you know, as one of the features of the exhibit, you can enter a 20s era speakeasy.
Whoa!
And you have to knock on the door and come up with the password, and the door opens and you're allowed in, and you can learn about the fabulous nightlife of the
1920s. Ernie sent me the password. Yeah, the exhibit Dan Spock's talking about opens 2 weeks from today, covering 7,000 square feet of
That's
space.
Right.
This is a big one. Mm-hmm. It's called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, and it'll have a lot of Minnesota angles about it too, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be preceded by a party. A great big blowout party the night before. We're going to take a break here, George. We'll come back and tell you about the party and a bit more about when America went dry, but not really. To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barber shop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
I want to be an artist.
I'm going to be a dancer or a sewer like my mommy.
I'll be a fireman.
But first you have to quit sucking your thumb.
All of you are important to America, and if you work hard, you can be anything you want to be. God has a plan and a mission just for you.
He does.
That's right, and that's why you are America's greatest natural resource. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski, and I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America, the Billboard People. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of information or would like to support the life-saving work of Pro-Life Across America, please call 1-800-366-7773 or visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America, educational and non-political.
I can suck my thumb before I was even born.
Well, we're in the middle of full immersion into the subject of prohibition across America. Of course, Minnesota included in that from 1920 to 1933. This in conjunction with a soon-to-open exhibit at the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul is called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And with us, Dan Spock of the Minnesota History Center. And Dan opens 2 weeks from today. The night before, going to be a great big blowout party up there at the History Center.
Yeah, we got the Bootleggers Ball. So, you know, if you've got some vintage wear that you want to break out.
You're talking clothes, not booze.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there will be booze there because now by law we can have a liquor license.
Yeah,
but,
okay. That's nice to know.
Yeah. Okay. But this should be a really fun way to explore the exhibit and just kind of get into the spirit of the Roaring Twenties.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll have a speakeasy there. This is a one-night-only thing. So this will be the night of November 8th. Let's see. You can pose for a gangster mugshot there, too, huh?
Yep. Yeah. That's a feature of the exhibit where you can get into a police lineup and get your picture taken and email it to all of your friends.
Oh, that's great. So what good, clean fun. And you're not going to have a still there, are you, that we can make our own stuff? I don't think we can go that far.
That's a fairly complicated process.
How would you know? Well, Prohibition, as you said, the only time that it ever happened in the history of our country with the Constitution, one amendment repeals another.
Yeah.
Right? So the 21st did away with Prohibition
yeah.
in 1933. Dan, the legacy of Prohibition, it failed in almost every respect, right?
Well, that can't be said with absolute certainty because, one of the things I think the exhibit does a really good job of pointing out is that America really did have a drinking problem before Prohibition. And, it makes a point of saying, like, for example, in 1830, Americans per capita were consuming three times as much alcohol as they do today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people were drunk all of the time, and most of them were men. You know, they drank in the morning, they drank at lunch, they drank to cement business deals, they drank at night, and so it's easy now in retrospect to kind of look at that and say, well, what a silly idea. But it was drinking was a profound part of American life, and it had a profound effect on people. Certainly people did everything they could to circumvent it who really needed to drink, but during Prohibition. But drinking has never gotten back to where it was before Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a dirty little secret, but it's true that mm-hmm. Prohibition did actually succeed in suppressing drinking mm-hmm. in the United States, and it stuck to a large degree.
Yeah. Yeah. Some states, I think Kansas until the 1970s or 80s, were still dry.
That's right. So states could continue to be dry.
And in fact,
a lot of states were dry before national prohibition because this movement was at first being initiated at a statewide level.
Yep. All that being said, it is still true that prohibition encouraged criminality. No doubt about that. We've talked about that.
Absolutely. And ingenuity. Fantastic ingenuity.
GI ingenuity. People could find ways to drive around the law. Americans great at that. And, of course, prohibition institutionalized hypocrisy, for sure. It deprived the government, as you said, of revenue.
Yeah.
And it created a culture of official corruption and... really did impose profound limits on individual rights, too.
Yeah, well, I think another legacy of Prohibition is the nationalization of police power. The Bureau of Investigation, which had originally been created to investigate Reds and, mm-hmm. and communists mm-hmm. and anarchists and other radical elements in the United States, shifted over a period of time to criminality associated with Prohibition. And then... used episodes, violent episodes, as a way to argue for arming themselves up and mm-hmm. increasing their power. As there are a number of things that you might not immediately think of
right.
that are durable legacies of Prohibition.
Okay. And in the Ken Burns, I think it's a six-hour piece on mm-hmm. a look at Prohibition on PBS. It was out a few years ago. Burns notes that during Prohibition, drunken driving and cirrhosis of the liver actually increased because amateur batches of wood alcohol were more toxic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the old idea of
stuff.
Rot gut.
the rot yeah. gut, which was deadly.
Yeah, because people were getting drunk any way they could. So you've got terrible examples of maladies like Jake leg, which was something that you would get from drinking a particular type of medicinal booze that was bulked up with a powerful neurotoxin. So it would pass... the inspection of federal authorities, but it had this terrible effect on people and paralyzed hundreds of people in the United States.
What do you call it? Jake leg?
Jake leg was what the malady was called because the tonic was called Jamaican something. Yeah, so part of the problem with making liquor illegal is that people's desire to drink... meant that there was no regulation whatsoever. So safety was the least of people's concerns in producing this illegal hooch.
Let me share with you a brief timeline as far as Minnesota goes during Prohibition. 1922, St. Paul Police Chief, and this would be 2 years into Prohibition. So mm-hmm. 1922, St. Paul Police Chief Michael Gebhardt estimates that 75% of the city's residents are making wine or moonshine. That's pretty high. Yeah. Huh? 1924, 17 Minneapolis residents die of alcohol poisoning over a four-week period, something we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. 1925, a Collier's Magazine survey ranks San Francisco and St. Paul as the two wettest cities in the nation. Bravo for St. Paul, right in there.
Sopping wet.
1927, Frank Cloutier and the Victoria Cafe Orchestra make the first commercial label recordings in the Twin Cities, including a song called The Moonshiner's Dance. How about that? And September 12th, 1933, 59 Minnesota counties vote to repeal prohibition. Eventually, we got it done and got it off the books.
That's right.
Right.
Well, you know, one of the stories about repeal is, of course, it happens during the Depression. The Federal Treasury took such a hit with so many people being out of work and not paying income tax at the same level that they started eyeing those illegal booze profits and realizing, you know, the Federal Treasury at one point was supported 40% by liquor taxes. Maybe we should reconsider this whole thing and see, since as poor as people are, they're still drinking. Maybe we can get back to getting some revenue for the Treasury off of this. So, you know, one of the same sort of mechanisms that made prohibition possible ultimately also made repeal possible.
Yeah. We have mentioned a couple of books, and I think they're all on sale at the Minnesota History Center there in your gift shop, your bookshop, and we've mentioned on one already. It's very popular. It's just recently out and published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press, called Secret Partners, Big Tom Brown and the Barker Gang.
Yeah.
Big Tom, of course, chief of police, crooked as a dog's hind leg. George, did you get this one? I think I saw you over the book.
I do have it.
You're right. You're going to in for a good read. The big one here that covers the national sweep of prohibition is called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition by Daniel Okrent.
Great book.
Great book. Been out there for a couple of years. You can find it. A Valley bookseller can get it for you if you can't find it elsewhere. There's another one called Twin Cities Prohibition, Minnesota's Blind Pigs and Bootleggers. Blind pigs was a term for speakeasies.
That's right.
Yep. And that is by Elizabeth Johannek, Johannek. I think that's at the History Center, too. And, of course, kind of the Bible of gangland in the Twin Cities, especially St. Paul in the 20s and 30s, is Paul Maccabee's excellent John Dillinger Slept Here. And I love the subtitle, A Crook's Tour of Crime and Corruption in St. Paul, 1920 to 1936. And there's plenty to write about, isn't there?
Yep.
A new one, and Dan, from your press again, Minnesota Historical Society Press, is called Soda Shop Salvation, Recipes and Stories from the Sweeter Side of Prohibition.
Right. And you think about, you know, some of the breweries actually switched their operations to soda pop production and were able to survive through Prohibition. Shell's Brewery in New Ulm is one of those examples.
Right. Yeah. A lot of them went down. A lot of the breweries failed and never came back, right?
Yep.
But somehow Schmitz and Hams, they made it, didn't they?
Huh? Yeah, that, without interruption, apparently.
The book, Soda Shop Salvation, Recipes and Stories from the Sweeter Side of Prohibition, written by Ray Catherine Amy. I've had her on before. She's written a book about how food won the war in World War I. It's an excellent book. And now she gives us all kinds of ideas about what soda fountains had to offer for booze-deprived Americans, Minnesotans.
That's right.
During Prohibition. Yep. So a good library shelf full of books on the subject. And just go to your local bookseller, and we hope it's the Valley Bookseller here in Stillwater when you're down this year.
Yeah.
And at the History Center, too.
Yeah, and I should just pitch a couple of programs that we got coming up.
Please do.
You know, last year we had a big Black Friday event, and it was a huge smash, so we're doing it again. So if you missed it last year, you just get up bright and early. It's the day after Thanksgiving. There's free admission from 6 to 9 a.m. And big discounts at the shop.
Wow.
So you can explore the exhibit then if you'd like.
Good.
Over the holiday weekend, we've got tons of programming for families with kids, and even an exhibit like Prohibition has some pretty neat interactive stuff for kids to do.
For kids.
So, yeah. So,
what would those be?
Well, we just think there's no point in in starting kids too late on history. Get them interested early on. But
right.
You know, one of my favorite interactives in the exhibit is that you can pilot a police patrol boat,
really?
And try to interdict booze smugglers in Puget Sound.
Can I try that too? Can
yeah,
I do
yeah,
that?
You could definitely
thank you.
Do it,
okay,
Stan.
I'm
sure you'd be very good at
I'm
it.
I'm sure I wouldn't be.
But one of the things you learn is how underpowered the police boats were compared to the bootleggers who had every incentive to speed things up.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's a great exhibit. Once again, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, opening November 9th at the History Center in St. Paul on Kellogg Boulevard, running through March, the middle of March.
Yeah.
Okay. And you got another one real fast. We got a couple seconds left. You got another one coming up.
Yeah, we're working on an exhibit called Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Whoa.
So if you're a baby boomer, this is your territory. We're digging into, you know, the great stories around toys of that time period and how they were marketed to kids through Saturday morning cartoons.
Well, that'd be like you and me.
And all that kind of, yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Right. What were your toys? What were your favorites?
Well, I loved Hot Wheels, of course. Yeah, Captain Action was one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me started. I won't stop if you turn that button.
Tonka
that
Toys,
button.
But, right here in the Twin Cities.
That's
they were
right.
A national maker.
That's
they?
Right. And the Shopper Toy Company and Nerf products
Nerf
were invented
trunks,
here. Yeah.
Nerf ball and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
This is going to be terrific. This is when will this be open at the History Center, Dan?
It's coming in May. Late May. So look for that in the spring. If you're into toys, you want to take a trip down memory lane, this is a beautiful exhibit for
I
you.
Do, and I will. That's great. Yeah. And Dan Smock, back to the more immediate exhibit coming up, opening 2 weeks from today again on Prohibition. Do we get to see Carrie Nation's actual hatchet, the one that this little grandma-type lady went into saloons and bashed their booze?
That's definitely a feature in the exhibit. So
if
you admire tough little women who will stop at nothing to keep people from drinking, it's a terrific artifact.
And one other thing I see, part of the exhibit, something called Mr. Dry, a bar set from the 1920s. This is in the shape of a coffin. What is that?
Well, it basically has on there the date of Prohibition, and then it's got a blank spot for repeal. It's as though it's anticipating repeal, so you're putting the dry guy in the coffin.
Okay.
It's a bottle stopper.
Now, do people have to register for that party November 8th, the night before the...
Yes, they do. So they need to go to the website at mnhs.org. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's it. And again, you can pose for gangster mugshots. You can dance to live Dixieland jazz that night, right? The Southside Aces is the name of the group. You can learn the Charleston. And Dan, I want to see you doing the shimmy, okay, out there. And you can compete for prizes in amateur dance-offs. Sample local beers by Summit and Lucid Brewing. Sip moonshine cocktails, right? Going to be designed just for the evening. And you can create a souvenir keepsake. Oh,
that's
we
right.
owe so much to Prohibition, don't we, Dan?
Yeah.
What a marvelous time it wasn't. Dan Spock from the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul. Thank you so much for coming by, Dan.
Thank you, Stan.
Looking forward to the exhibit as always. It'll be a good one. And looking down the pike a little bit to springtime and toys. I want to be there, too.
Yeah, you got to see it.
Everybody, thank you so much for your company. It is, what do we have, 45 degrees in the Twin Cities today, and we're looking for a high today about there. I think not much higher. We're already over the projected high for today. Going to be breezy today. What's tomorrow? Mostly sunny, a high near 54. Thanks for your company. Have a great week. We'll catch you Monday at noon for the All Request and Dedication Lunch Hours.